Hi, folks. Welcome to the Wildlife For You podcast, where we talk about wildlife and conservation in ways that make sense. Today's episode is a special extra edition episode. I am your host, Stephanie Payne, and I'm joined here by my bestie, Daryl Ratajczak. Before Daryl has a chance to interrupt, I'm actually going to go ahead and admit that I derailed this week's planned topic a bit so we could do this extra edition. All because of a TV show that I saw that really impacted me. I literally started texting Daryl halfway through that show, just going off.
Yeah, she is not kidding, folks. Smack dab in the middle of family movie night. Anyway, so much for me watching Hamilton and having my undivided attention to the. I was gonna bust out a song on Hamilton, but I'm not gonna do that. So, anyway, if anything warrants Stephanie interrupting her like typical Friday night party scene debauchery, I knew it had to be important.
Okay, freaking Hamilton. Are you serious?
Yes, it wasn't my choice. Let's just leave it at that.
Okay. And the party scene debauchery. Yeah. I don't know which one I find more appalling, but anyway. All right. So back to the topic. This podcast episode is about taking something you watch that makes you have a visceral reaction and then educating yourself to make an informed decision versus a fed. Well, excuse the pun, but hook, line, and sinker version.
Okay, hold it right there, Steph. You chided me last week for kind of beating around the bush in the introduction, so I'm going to get on you here. What program specifically are we talking about?
Oh, yeah, right. The program I watched was called Seaspiracy. It's a documentary about the commercial fishing industry.
All right, now we're getting somewhere. At least we know what today's episode is going to be all about. Now, I do know that that show, that Seaspiracy show, I know it's in the top 10 on Netflix right now. But let's assume our listeners haven't watched it. So I imagine we should probably tell them a little bit about it first before we start dissecting it.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So the story starts with an ocean conscious young man who goes anti-plastic after some very publicized deaths of whales, dolphins, and other marine creatures that had like dozens of pounds of plastics stuck in their digestive system. So he learns more about one of the giant plastic waste piles in the ocean. These exist, by the way, and are thousands of miles in size. But he makes a mission actually of his own to start picking up plastic from beaches, but he really feels like he's not making enough of a difference.
Yeah, and from there he goes on to learn that these plastics that are floating around, and you could picture like milk jugs and those big hunks of plastic, whether or not it's straws or those infamous soda bottle wrapper things that are always catching birds. Anyway, those things eventually they do break down, and what they do is they create these microplastics, which are then eaten by even more marine life, not just those iconic sea animals. So at this point in the documentary, he learns that Japan has started whaling again. And they're going against this anti-whaling world treaty that has been in place for literally decades. And he's curious then, which kills more whales, plastics and pollution or whaling? So the show then starts to focus on whaling, specifically Japan and Norway and Iceland too.
So time for me to jump on a rant. So I did some research, and to be honest, I'm actually shocked they didn't spend more time talking about Norway or Iceland or Japan. Well, mostly Japan when it comes to whaling. So quick facts that they got right. Whaling was banned globally in 1986. I think the only clauses were for research and subsistence whaling. That for transparency, I am 100% anti-whaling for commercial purposes. I have no problem with subsistence whaling, and since most research is conducted with live specimens, I generally have no problem with research.
Before you go much further, should I explain subsistence harvesting?
Sure.
Okay, well, I said subsistence harvesting. You were talking about subsistence whaling. Both of those terms there, obviously, you have a key word in subsistence. And so, subsistence whaling, or harvesting, as I said, is when a group of people or a culture, for the most part, they harvest a resource for the benefit of their people, for literally for food consumption. So They are taking the meat off an animal, whatever animal that may be, whether or not it's marine or terrestrial, but they're harvesting that meat to feed themselves, literally to feed their people, to keep their people alive. It is non-commercial. They're not killing animals to sell it. They're literally killing and eating and consuming those animals to survive. That's subsistence whaling or subsistence harvesting.
Yep. And it's not even just the eating. They use those things for, they'll use skins, they use the oil, the
Yes.
blubbers. I mean, they literally use it for every aspect of their
Oh,
life.
yeah.
So there's very little
Yeah,
waste.
I think one of the really easy things for people to identify, the American bison, the Plains Indians, it was subsistence hunting of the Plains bison. They used every single piece of that bison whenever they harvested one.
Yeah. So again, in 1986, we saw a global ban on whaling. Almost immediately, Japan began hunting whales, claiming it was for research. But there have been tons and tons of allegations that it was just whale hunting, thinly disguised as research. They were busted, for example, whaling, air quotes, for research inside of the Australian whale sanctuary. And time again, they were ordered to stop, and time again, they ignored those orders, and thereby ignored the international law set under the IWC, or the International Whaling Convention. So Australia at one point even took Japan to international court, and I didn't even know that was a thing, like that there was an international court. But anyhow, the court ruled in favor of Australia because the amount of scientific literature from Japan totally didn't account for the number of whales that they were killing. And for the record, that whaling ban is almost impossible to enforce. It's a big old ocean, and not only is it hard to catch the people at it, but it's nearly impossible to levy any real penalties against these guys. So, long story short, in 2019, Japan decided that they no longer needed that research, guys, and they just flat out announced that they were going to return to commercial whaling, which they have done, even though their commercial whale hunting proposal was rejected by the IWC. So, when that happened, Japan just said, okay, fine, we're not going to be a member anymore. And they withdrew their membership from the IWC, which I'm not even sure how they did. I mean, international whaling, as soon as you get out of your terrestrial waters that's designed for, your sovereignty, then suddenly you're international. Anyway, I digress. That's like a bad loop to get into. But the only good news that supposedly there's no government subsidies for Japan's whaling industry now. But I will say that there was $47.3 million subsidized in Japan for the Japan whaling industry in 2019. I did find evidence of that, but honestly,
Do we need to explain a subsidy?
giving money to artificially lower cost. Is
Yeah.
that
Well, yeah, 'cause sometimes, like, if you're farming, if you're producing food, and the farmers get a subsidy to make sure that they're not that they're still getting the amount of pay, regardless of the cost of what those foods come out to be. They get paid money to help them out, so to speak. And so
Yeah.
Japan literally lost $47.3 million in 2019.
Well, they no, Japan's government gave the whaling industry $47.3 million to make it so that it was not to the point where they were going to have to charge an absolutely outrageous
Yeah.
price to
Yes.
sell their whale products.
Yes, correct.
So yeah, I mean, lose it, whatever you want to call it. It's literally just it's giving them money so that the public doesn't have to foot that bill with the cost of the actual product.
Gotcha.
But I mean, and while I say that the good news is there's supposedly no government subsidies now, I will say I have not been able to ferret out if that factoid is true. Anyhow, though, it is insinuated without those subsidies, it would be very hard for Japanese whalers to keep practicing their trade because, it's really, really expensive, and the cost of the product wouldn't be worth anything. It's not monetarily feasible. But anyway, Japan and those other countries that we mentioned, they actually say that their breaking of this international whaling ban won't hurt overall whale populations. For the record, I found no credible proof to back up that claim. Furthermore, trying or tying commercial, you were saying a minute ago, we were talking about subsistence harvesting. That's often tied to cultures. So Japan tying commercial whaling to their cultural mores.
Mores, that's the beliefs, not the eels.
Yes, so tying commercial whaling to cultural beliefs, as all three of these countries have done, and calling that a justifiable reason for whaling is problematic. They're saying it's part of their cultural mores because they've been doing it for a real long time. Problem is, it's still commercial. Subsistence whaling, sure, that's a huge difference between subsistence and commercial whaling. And that's where my issue is with whaling. I don't, dislike that practice because I have issues with the culture of any place. I have issues with it because it's commercialized, meaning it's driven by money, by profits, not by culture. And it absolutely chaps my butt that the main Japanese whaling area is in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. I mean, anyway, end rant, sorry.
No, that was a really good rant, and you were on such a roll. I kind of left you alone there, even though I did interrupt you a tad bit. I was, just so you know, I was going to jump in with a much bigger tangent, but dang, that is a pretty good introduction into whaling.
Yeah, so dare I ask about that tangent you were kicking around?
Well, now that you mention it.
Okay, what have I done?
Well, have you ever seen? I will tell you, I was a fanatic to this television series called Whale Wars. Did you ever watch it or hear about it?
No. I mean, hear about
Okay.
it, yes. Watch it now.
Okay. It was all about exactly what you described. And what it was this series that documented the escapades of this environmental group called. Well, they're on this boat called the Sea Shepherd that would target the Japanese whaling fleet. And they also had another boat called the Bob Barker. And yes, that's the same Bob Barker from Come On Down. You're the next contestant on The Price is Right. He funded a lot of that I'm going to call
Activity.
it eco-terroristic activities, because I watched that show, and most people watching that show, they think it's good versus evil. And I tell you what, Steph, I watched that show and I was fixated because I was so mad. I considered it evil versus evil. It was like two little toddlers that don't know any better, duking it all out. And I was getting so frustrated. I shouldn't say it, but I wanted bad things to happen to both of them. I wanted the Japanese to stop the whaling, but I wanted the Sea Shepherd to, I wanted their boat to sink. I didn't want anyone to get killed, but I wanted their boats to sink, because that eco-terrorism, that taking things into your own hands, is just as much. It's, we always talk about, like, you have radical left, radical right. And that's exactly what this was. It was just two radical groups going at it. And we can't survive in today's world being radicalized. We've got to be somewhere in the middle. And there's one point where I believe the Japanese were ready to sit down at the international table to discuss their whaling practices, but they were using this eco-terrorism as a reason to say, oh, we're not coming to the table because we're still getting bothered and hounded by this group over here. So it irked me to no end. And it's, like I said, most people watching it see good versus bad. And that type of situation, I can't help but tell you, it is bad versus bad. We can't have extremism leading the way. Now, it calls to light some of the issues, but it's definitely something that was not going to solve any problems doing it the way that they were doing it. Anyway, I think Bob Barker would have had better things to do with his money. So, anyway. Now, because of that show and what you just explained, I now know more about whaling than I ever thought I needed to know. But going back to that whole Seaspiracy documentary, from a whaling standpoint, the show then it moves into dolphin harvesting and trade in Japan. And it talks about the value of dolphins to water parks for the entertainment industry. But it further paints the Japanese as literally exterminating dolphins because they're competition against Japanese commercial fishing. And from here, we move to the commercial harvesting of tuna.
And I will say here that tuna and dolphins do like to eat a lot of the same foods, like herring, mackerel, and squid. So, let's talk about the world's favorite chicken of the sea and where they stand from a conservation perspective. So, southern bluefin, and these are some of the ones that were mentioned on the show. Southern bluefin tuna are critically endangered. Atlantic bluefin tuna is endangered. I think that's the one they specifically, I can't remember which one they mentioned specifically, because they just said bluefin. Anyway, albacore are near threatened, and big eye tuna is vulnerable. So, for the record, all canned tuna is either albacore, or the ones that are labeled just white tuna. Those are generally skipjack. And currently, skipjack tuna do have a stable conservation status. Anyway, the show actually talks about a single bluefin tuna that sold in a Japanese auction for $400,000, which I did find evidence to support that fact. So, real quick, let's talk about what tuna are.
They're fish. But before you do that stuff, let me clarify something about tuna pricing. Believe it or not, I'm a little bit, I shouldn't say learned, but I did hear some information about the tuna prices. When you hear those astronomical, ungodly amounts being paid for tuna, typically what that is at the start of a tuna season, it's very symbolic. And at the start of the tuna season, the first tuna that comes in, there will be bidding wars amongst like extremely wealthy people to purchase that first tuna. And so when you get those literally ungodly amounts of money for a single tuna, it's because of this cultural tradition of being the first to have that first tuna. Now, I will tell you, tuna are still insanely expensive. You watch the tuna shows on TV, and those individual fish are going for a few thousand dollars to $15,000. But those, like I said, those insane amounts, that's literally a symbolic auction for the first tuna coming in for the season. So, anyway, you were talking about what tuna are, and I cleared it up perfectly that they were fish.
Thank you, Captain Obvious. Okay,
You're welcome.
what I meant was that tuna are a top predator in oceanic terms. Like many other top predators, that means that they often take quite some time to reach sexual maturity so that they can breed. And, well, D, remind our listeners of what happens when a top predator is removed or significantly reduced.
Yes, ma'am, because we talk about this quite a bit. And we obviously love apex predators here. And we often discuss trophic cascades and what happens when you remove an apex predator from a system. And you have this cascade effect where the entire system gets disrupted. So you have to understand that there are different levels to any ecosystem. And having too many of one thing can really, really throw things out of whack. And we talk about wolves and elk and deer. And when, for example, when you have those middle level trophic creatures, and I'm flailing here, Steph, so clarify or help me. But when you have too many of the animals that are eating, say, the plant life, that can wreak more havoc on the system than anything else. So it's absolutely critical you have apex predators to keep those middle level species in check. And that's what tuna happen to be.
So just think of it, and they do a little bit of a visual of this in the show, but just think of it as the really big apex predators are taking out the next smaller size, and keeping those numbers in check. And keeping those numbers in check means that those slightly smaller size, they're eating just about, the balanced amount of ones that are smaller than them. They're eating the ones that are smaller than them. So it's literally just, it's a food chain if you think about it. So if you take that top one out, if you either take it out or drastically reduce the number in that, then that second level, the population numbers explode because they're no longer under that pressure anymore. There's nothing keeping their population in check. So that starts to run amok. It literally, those guys start eating too many of the next one, and so on and so forth. So it can really devastate it. From the other direction, if you have these big guys that eat too many of those slightly, and I'm not talking the apex, so the next smaller ones down. If you have too many of those slightly smaller ones that are taking out the ones that eat the smallest, those smallest then run amok and eat all of the vegetation. So, I mean, at the end of the day, that trophic cascade and all of these animals that have this harmony going on, that harmony is required for that balance. So it keeps everything healthy. You need all of the parts to make the clock work. You take out the big gear, the clock stops working. That's
Yes.
kind of what it boils down to. So anyway, so back real quick to what's in those cans of tuna, because I do want to make that distinction, because canned tuna is a staple. Let's be honest. And what goes in those cans is mostly a staple, and that would again mostly be skipjack tuna, unless you're aiming specifically for that albacore label. As a reminder, albacore is near threatened. That's just me saying, just so you know, if you buy albacore, you're buying a nearly threatened species. But skipjack is stable, and part of the reason for that stability is because skipjack are a small tuna. They are fast maturing, and that means they breed quicker, and they mature to breed again at a faster rate, and they're also lower on the food chain. So for the record, that also means that the amount of mercury that's found in skipjack tends to be lower than those other tuna species that I mentioned, because the mercury kind of compounds in the system. So if you got a really little guy and he eats something that has mercury, he's got a very little bit of mercury. The next size up, he's eating a whole lot of those little guys, so he's getting all of their mercury plus his own. And that kind of keeps compounding as you go up. So it's actually ironic, because those high-priced tuna are also, well, first off, they're iffy on long-term survival at this rate, because the populations, are, like I said, they're either critically endangered, endangered, or vulnerable, whatever. They run that gamut. But again, because they're top predators in the fish world, that means they have higher levels of mercury and lots of other things that aren't actually super safe to eat, in large quantities because of that. So.
So they aren't super safe to eat, but they can be tasty. But I digress. So now from that point, the show moves into commercial fishing as a whole. And it starts to talk about the number of fishing nets and products that literally contribute to the ocean trash and all that bycatch that takes place.
Yeah, and bycatch is also called accidental take, and it essentially means anytime a species is caught, captured, or killed that isn't the target species. So it's not what they're trying to catch. It just gets caught anyway, and that's really not specifically unique to commercial fishing.
Yeah, and I appreciate that definition stuff, but I'm not so sure I'd classify it as accidental, though. Because when you think about it, an accident occurs when you don't intend for something to happen. So when they're out there and they're laying out these long ass fishing nets, say for tuna, and they don't want to catch other species in them, but they know full well it's going to happen, I'm not so sure how accidental anything is.
True.
Anyway. Again, I digress. I'll stop digressing here. But from that point on in that documentary, from bycatch and fishing tactics, it moves more to a humanitarian concern as it relates to commercial fishing. And then it moves to this concept of certification organizations like Dolphin Safe or what they call MCS, the Marine Stewardship Council. And it discusses their certification practices. And I am so sorry about this, but I got to call a timeout again and go on a tangent with certification standards. Because I got to relate to something that has occurred throughout my career that you can understand and the public can understand what we're talking about here.
Okay, tangent on.
Way back when in my career, I was working for the Isaac Walton League of America, which is a conservation organization based out of DC. And prior to one of our staff meetings, I was sitting in the boardroom and there was a magazine on the table. It was one of the outdoor magazines, and I was just thumbing my way through it. And I turned to this one full page ad for an ATV. I don't know if it was Yamaha, Honda, what brand it was, but right away, the ad struck me because it was this photograph of a person riding their ATV, and they had just run over a ruffed grouse, which is a small chicken-like bird, a wild bird. And the bird wasn't harmed, and the caption said, "So much ground clearance, even the dumbest birds are safe." And that was the ad. And what caught my eye was the stamp at the bottom of the ad that said, "This ad approved by Tread Lightly." And Tread Lightly is this certification group that promotes responsible and ethical environmental stewardship. Like when you're riding ATVs, you don't try to cause resource damage. And the fact that this ATV is riding over a ruffed grouse and it was stamped with their approval, I was like, WTF in capital letters. And believe it or not, Steph, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but I was then given this project of looking more into the whole Tread Lightly and what's going on there. And you would not believe all the instances where they were given a stamp of approval for some absolutely terrible ethical practices on ATVs, like driving up the middle of streams, but is getting the stamp of approval. And so I wrote this little expose about Tread Lightly because they were funded by guess who? Yamaha, Honda. And so I did this expose, and I remember, like, after we published this, it was like a 20-page document. After we published it, ESPN did rebuttal, saying that I'm this stupid, don't know anything about whatever, because Tread Lightly is a great organization. And I remember walking into my boss's office with a tear in my eye. I think I'm going to get fired because they just destroyed my report. And my boss laughed at me. He says, "Dude, when you are trying to raise awareness, there is no such thing as bad press." And the fact that ESPN was publishing something about your article was a good thing to bring that issue to light. So anyway, the whole certification thing, yeah, I've got lots of experience with how that can be good, but how it can also not be good. Anyway, I'll get back to the Seaspiracy. The documentary from that point, it then moves to commercial fish farming, and it finally creates controversy literally around any means of possibly having any sustainable fishing. And it begins to promote like plant-based imitation seafood as the only safe alternative. And so tell me, Steph, I know you both loved and despised this show. Why? And just so you know, before you answer, I'm bursting at the seams to say something about the plant-based alternatives, but I've already been on a whole bunch of soapboxes already. I might grab a couple more, but I'll let you take the floor for a bit.
Thanks. So, well, the show was very well done. At parts of it, I did literally feel like face palming because some of it is very spot on. I mean, let's talk about long lining, trawling, and long netting, Dee. Maybe if we explain just at a high level what those are in practice, people can inherently understand some of the challenges, especially with the bycatch.
Okay. Now, I will tell you, fishing's not my specialty, but believe it or not, my oldest brother is a fisheries biologist, so I do know a little bit, but I did research some of this. And long line fishing, or long lining, what it is, it's a commercial fishing technique that uses, as the name suggests, literally a long line called the main line, which has baited hooks, and they're attached at intervals with branching lines. So the branch line, it's pretty much a short line that hangs away from the main line. And these main lines can be floated, so they're held near the surface, or they can be dropped to the ocean floor or lake bed. Sometimes they're even anchored, or sometimes they're even left to drift in the ocean. Literally hundreds to thousands of baited hooks can hang from these long lines. And so they're a method that is used to engage tuna, and to catch tuna and like halibut or sablefish or swordfish, and literally what other species is gonna take the bait.
Yeah. So long line fishing has been controversial for quite a while because it's only seeking certain commercial fish, obviously. But just like a normal fisherman out fishing in a pond, you can try to use bait and location to increase the odds of catching what you want to catch. But first off, you can't control what takes the bait. And secondly, you mostly can't control the size, or maturity of what's taking the bait. So Literally, long lining is the same as putting thousands of asleep at the rod fishermen out in a big long line. You know, that's kind of what it boils down to, just minus the people element. So now for a normal individual sport fisherman, you know, generally if they, you know, they reel something in, they toss back anything that is either too small or the species, you know, any species that they weren't aiming for. So the irony here is that that guy that's out sport fishing, if he catches a fish that isn't a harvestable species, or one that isn't big enough, you know, he reels it in, he sees what it is, he unhooks it, he tosses it back. If he were to decide to ignore the rules and to keep that either unharvestable or too small species, he's fined. You know, he can be fined and lose his license, or worse. I personally have literally been out in the Gulf of Mexico fishing, and you know, my family and I, we were told, for example, that we couldn't keep any of these specific species of fish because they're air quotes out of season. Yet commercially, they're catching them all the time in the exact same waters. So me and my minimal damage, you know, to the ecological impact of catching one, you know, I'm not allowed to. I literally would lose my license and be fined. But yet it's okay for them. So while I couldn't keep the one that I caught that was of legal size, the commercial guy out longlining or netting can keep all of them, regardless of the size, or if it's, you know, if it's not what he's out looking for, he can just toss that corpse back in, if it happened to die before he got that fish aboard. But anyway, now maybe it's my turn to digress. But additional bycatch that we hear about often with longlining, other than small or different, you know, fish species and sharks that they catch, but it's oftentimes this bycatch. It's sharks and sea turtles, and actually with long lining, even seabirds like the albatross. And I will say though that there are some longliners who have started adopting this use of this thing called a hook pod, which does help with that seabird bycatch because seabirds, believe it or not, are actually impacted pretty hard by long lining. But anyway, it's long story short. It is really hard to limit what bites a hook.
Yes, and that's a great description of long lining. But then another tactic that they use is what's called trawling, which is essentially pulling a giant net behind one or more boats. But here's the thing, that net is so big we don't even call it a net. We literally call it a trawl, TRAWL. Now, there's two main types of trawling. There's either bottom or midwater trawling. And as you can likely guess, it's all dependent on how high the trawl is in the water column. And so, bottom trawling is when that huge net, that trawl, is dragged on or near the seafloor. And it uses heavy weights to get it down to the bottom. And then it literally scoops up everything in its path. That means because it's on the bottom, it also stirs up and scoops up like sediment. It's really wreaking havoc on marine habitats. And there's actually research that shows it can play a role in algal blooms. Now, that's the bottom trawling. The midwater trawlers, they literally target that upper column of water. So if we think about tossing a net out and catching everything in its path, it obviously means there's little to no selectivity with what's caught. So species and size don't matter much to a net, but there's some nets that have larger mesh size to help get the undersized fish free. And one of the things I saw, and I don't know if it was in this documentary, but describing these trawl lines or these trawl nets, think of the African savanna. And if you were, say you were trying to harvest or gather up some type of gazelle, and you drop a giant net 100 miles by 100 miles, you drop a giant net over the African savanna trying to catch this gazelle. But guess what? You're gonna catch giraffes and zebras and lions and water buffalo and literally anything else that is on that savanna. How do you think that would go over with everyone if you're going after a gazelle, but you're killing all these other species? Well, that's exactly what's happened with this trawl system, this giant net that they're dragging. And so, anyway, the most common bycatch we hear with these trawls are things like dolphins and porpoises and sea turtles. You even get whales, and obviously sharks get caught up in that net. And for the record, trawling just isn't used to catch fish. Those shrimp boats that you see, the ones like on Forrest Gump, those are shrimp trawlers. And literally, I've seen some results that show those have some of the highest bycatch rates of all the trawling efforts.
Yeah. So, and obviously common sense would kick in, and we should realize that these commercial fishing techniques, they're gonna lead to a lot of bycatch. Like you just used the perfect word. When you're throwing out a giant net or thousands of hooks, literally there is zero selectivity going into what you are catching. You are just catching everything. And the irony is most bycatch is considered junk. I mean, literally, it's considered junk and it's tossed back into the sea, dead or alive. And, quite a few of those cases, even a live bycatch, if it's caught and it's actually still alive by the time it gets on board, it ends up dead because of the trauma associated with the whole process, whether it's, waiting to get, out of the net, whether it's just, it's just bad. It's going to be hard because the fishermen don't want to have to take that extra time to pull those things out either, or there's just the trauma where it swallowed a hook if it was, sitting on a hook for quite a period of time. But anyway, again, it's nothing like sport fishing. Sport fishing gets beat up, quite a bit, in the public spotlight. And in sport fishing, you feel a bite, you reel it in, and you toss it right back if it's the wrong thing or if it's too small. And if that, again, if that sport fisherman decides not to follow the rules and to kill or keep the fish and they're caught, they're paying a hefty price with fines and losses, loss of their license. But it's just commercial bycatch, they don't play by the same rules. The same thing occurs in a massive scale and nothing happens. And it's just absolutely, to me personally, that is an unacceptable double standard. All for the sake of profit, and it just totally chaps my butt.
Well, I know it chapped your butt, and I can tell our listeners from firsthand experience, you are pretty fired up during and after watching that show because you interrupted my Hamilton adventure. But I
Wait.
will
Does
tell
Hamilton and adventure really go in the same sentence?
you, Hamilton experience. I won't tell you if it's good or bad. Anyway, I really do think you sent me more text in that hour than you have ever sent, and you literally flat out demanded that I watch it. So let's talk about some of that. What was it that specifically triggered you?
And for the record, I am not apologizing that I interrupted Hamilton. You were probably secretly like, sweet.
Yeah.
Anyway, what really got under my skin was the bias that was thrown into the documentary. The majority of the people that they were selecting to add commentary to, air quote, establish the facts are very, like you said earlier, they are these very hardcore activist extremists. And, I know that you kind of mentioned this before and you did a great job at it, but in my head, the only comparison that I could make is, well, it's like using Muslim extremists to tell the world about Islam. It's going to be very colorful and slanted. It's not
Yeah.
going to be what the general everyone thinks. It's going to be that really extremist mentality. So
Point of view, yeah.
yeah, and the problem is the general public does not realize that. They don't realize the selectivity that goes into the people that you're going to let, air quote, speak facts, And I only researched some of these folks because just a couple of them were using some very specific language that made my spidey senses start tingling, especially the dude at the fish farm. I can't even remember his name. But some of the actual, between the posture that he had while he was doing what he did and the words that he spoke, he to me was screaming that he is not an unbiased scientist who follows the facts, that he was in fact a an ecological extremist. And it was very, well, tainted. That's, tainted is the only word that I have.
Yeah, and just so you know, when I watched it, I was picking up on those things too, because one of the things that was mentioned, and I've heard this mentioned in a couple of different quote unquote extremist type of documentaries where they say, according to such and such research, all fish species will be gone by 2048. And that has already been debunked, but when people are spouting that, you know that they're trying to get you to believe some pretty outlandish stuff. But anyway, talk about the other clues on some of the sketchy stats. So
Like,
when
do you remember what every time the dude was trying to validate something that he heard, what did he always say?
refresh my
Oh,
memory.
he would be like, "Well, when I tried to research, there was a lot of conflicting data," and then he would give you the data that he selected.
Oh yeah. And that's, oh my gosh, that's so critical in critical thinking is you can't, whenever there's an argument, you can pick and choose what data will support your argument. But when it comes to critical thinking, you've got to use all the data, not just the hand-picked pieces of data.
And let's
So.
be honest about that show. It was very artfully done.
Oh, you mean like pretty much how they used all the images and the selective stories to get that gut reaction from their viewers.
Yes. I think the hardest part for me was how good it actually was at that. It was so well done. Being selective with information and using very emotional imagery to drive it home. It had like perfectly timed insertions of these gory scenes that the average viewer absolutely is not equipped to handle, which elicits that visceral emotional reaction.
Okay, I agree with you with how good it was at eliciting that emotional reaction, but I want to do my best rendition of trying to explain this to everyone. So if you don't mind, let me try taking a stab at that.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Now, here I was originally going to talk about fish farming, but you kind of spurred a thought in me regarding the gory scenes and how it relates to farming or should I say the reality of farming? And this is gonna go a little bit beyond fish farming, but at one point, the documentary really slammed fish farming, talking about how it was literally a guise for the wild-caught fishery, because believe it or not, farmed fish, they require fish meal. In other words, you have to catch and you have to feed wild fish to the farmed fish. And so throughout that documentary, they kept suggesting that like a plant-based diet as being pretty much guilt-free. As you know, plants require farming, but people need to understand the impact of regular farming practices, what that impact is on wildlife. It's literally not a guilt-free choice. For example, I was researching this whole topic and looking at additional information on fish farming, and I came across a really interesting study. It was actually, like I said, while I was researching fish farming, but this specific study wasn't really tied to fish. But what they showed is, now understand what I'm about to tell you. The numbers, they can be debated, but this will give you an idea of what I'm talking about. So if you're looking at producing food and you were to raise a free-ranging cow, meaning it feeds off the land, you have this cow, you let it go, it just does what a cow does and it feeds off the land. That cow can produce about 45 kilograms of pure protein. That means it would take 2.2 animals or cows that you would have to kill in this instance to produce 100 kilograms of protein. Now, if you're going to try to produce that same amount of protein, say growing carrots or some other vegetable, here's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to occupy some land. You're going to have to plow that land under. You're going to have to apply chemicals. You're going to have to do all those normal farming practices. And any farmer can tell you, you're having a major impact on that land. And even throughout the process of farming, you are disrupting and killing animals. And literally, in the end, you end up killing about 55 small mammals, for example, mice and anything else that's impacted by that loss of habitat. And so, in that process of growing that 100 kilograms of protein by vegetables, you're going to account for about 25 times more animal deaths by obtaining that plant-based protein. And like I said, I know these numbers can be debated until we're all blue in the face, but it's simply meant to show that this recommended alternative that they keep pushing on you as far as a plant-based diet, it's not so guilt-free as it's made out to be. So there's somewhat of an agenda because there's literally some science to refute many of their claims. And we're not even going to touch on the deforestation for farming needs. And
Yeah.
I should, do you want to say something?
Nope. I was just saying, yeah, I was amening
Oh.
you.
Oh, okay. We can't high five because we're about 1,000 miles apart. So anyway, I should add that one of the people they interviewed in the documentary of Seaspiracy, it was actually talking about this very similar example.
Are you referring to the pilot whale hunt on the Faroe Islands?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm referring to. Because if you can remember, and just so you know, the whale hunt on the Faroe Islands, one can argue that it's a subsistence hunt since the culture's been doing it since I believe the 9th century, and it's non-commercial. And so they're not doing this to sell the whale meat. They're doing this to feed the community. So they take what they eat and they eat what they take. So it's not for sale. So what impressed me was what he said on that documentary, the one gentleman they interviewed, and he said that one whale can feed multiple families for months on end. He then equated it to being equal to something like that one whale being worth the same amount of meat as like 2,000 chickens. And it actually made him feel better knowing he was only taking one life instead of all those other lives. And when you think about it, a life is a life. It doesn't matter if it's a whale or a mouse. And so it's a very legitimate argument when you think about it. So if there's an ethics soapbox that they're trying to get about killing animals, you got to start by looking in the mirror. So having said that, those images from that particular whale hunt, they were probably the most striking and horrific images in that entire program.
Yeah, they really, really were. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Daryl, here. This is just a question that you made me think of. If I'm subsistence hunting, as a general rule, the take is not more than the need either. Like they don't try to, exceed what they require because
Well,
they don't want it to go to waste either.
right, exactly. But what they're doing when they're doing a drive like that, obviously, especially nowadays, you can store meat for a long time. So they're going to take as much as they can get, and then they stock their shelves. It's not like, oh, we're just going to take one whale for the next couple of weeks or whatever. They'll kill so they can stock their pantries to make sure. For example, if the whales don't come back for a long time, they want to make sure they have enough foods to subsist.
Gotcha. And I agree that it was the most striking and horrific imagery within the program. And like at one point, I actually recall, and they would literally fade in, horrific scene, fade out. Fade in, horrific scene, fade out. On one of these, they faded in with a horrific scene, and they actually had text and an arrow pointing to one of these, I think they're pilot whales, and said pregnant female, and then it fades out. And I thought that was a little rude. It's kind of hard to tell a pregnant female until after the process when they've discovered during slaughtering her and storing her
But
that's for food.
you did notice, and I mentioned they've been doing this on that island since the 9th century. It is a community affair. This was what fed that community for centuries and centuries. And so it's not like they're out there and thousands of people were protesting it, and one or two guys were doing it. It was thousands of people were doing it, and he was doing the documentary on it.
Yeah,
And
it actually
not to justify that.
it probably looked more like hundreds of people, but I mean,
Right.
because it was a small community, so it wasn't a huge take.
Right. But
Anyway.
anyway, it's something that the community has done to feed their community for a very, very long time.
Yeah, and again, subsistence meaning it's for them. They don't sell it commercially, so they're not out, and it's very local. It is very local to their community that this actually occurs.
Yeah, you're not going out to the store to buy a Faroe Island pilot whale of the sea.
Yeah, true. Anyway, but that all of those striking images and the horrific images that were bringing out that visceral emotional reaction, that's actually what led me to think, okay, this smells like propaganda, and it smells like they have an agenda. So then I went in, because you know me, I can't, like, it is against my nature to not critically think. So I immediately, as soon as I was done watching the show, went into research mode. And I'll tell you right now, researching things about this topic was tough, because every easy to find thing was slanted either in favor of eliminating commercial fishing completely, and whaling, or in favor of commercial fishing. Whaling, obviously, way not lots of things saying, no, we should be in favor of whaling. But it was either pro fishing, commercial fishing, or it was anti-commercial fishing. And everything in the article, it tried to read like it was an unbiased fact, and in an unbiased article full of facts, but everything felt like it had a slant to it. So I literally then had to start researching who was responsible for creating that article to see where their financial ties were, you know. And if I saw this about us, and I get to the point where it's saying that this is supported, you know, by, and it's commercial fishing industries, I had to throw it out. Literally, I can't trust them to tell me the truth. I can't
It's
trust
like,
the activists to tell me the truth.
yeah, it's like doing a fact search, and everything you come back is produced by CNN or Fox.
Yeah, agreed. It literally, everything is slanted to give you only one angle of fact. It is not to show a whole picture. So I literally had to start taking pieces instead of trying to look at any of this holistically. So I started going through, you know, like the science of Japan, or excuse me, the history of Japan, with their claims of doing this for research and whatnot. And then, you know, the science, looking at, okay, what are the actual endangered species, and what is it like, you know, what is the stability of fishes in the oceans, and I'm talking in mass. So I will say, I did not have a whole lot of time. It's only been a couple of days, and I didn't I, we don't have a team of folks that run these down, every facet of what we want to know. But I can say, just from the research that you and I have both done, there is a lot of agendas and propaganda and misinformation flying around out there labeled as truths.
Yep.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, I personally don't think that commercial fishing, as it's done en masse, is a good practice or sustainable, simply because of the amount of bycatch. But I get it. There's a lot of mouths to feed in our world, and that is a fact we all know.
Yeah, and I'm gonna go on tangent number four real quick, because we kind of talked about this over the last day or so about commercial fishing. And the problem with commercial fishing is it takes place in international waters. Like, if you're protecting a resource and you are a state agency, or just look at the US in general, if we're watching over the resources we're in charge of, whether or not it's the natural resources, wildlife resources, we know how much we can or should take before there's an impact. So we regulate our own take, because our country literally controls, or there's a finite amount within our country. When it comes to fishing in international waters, there's no one country that oversees international waters. And so commercial fishing, it's pretty much a free for all out there. And you mentioned it before, there's no enforcement. There's like loose regulations, but it appears they're not followed. It's not sustainable in that way, in that it literally can't be regulated just because it's a global or international area that's being fished. So anyway, you mentioned there's a lot of mouths to feed in the world, in this world. And that's literally the $50 million question we're trying to answer. How in the world do we feed all the people? And if you look at it right now, the human population, we're just under 8 billion people. It's like 7.8 billion people. And that's projected to hit 10 billion humans by 2015. That sucks, is what. And you know how we're always talking about carrying capacity when it comes to wildlife? We really, really need to start thinking about carrying capacity of the earth when it comes to humans. And so it's well known we're fast approaching that, but it seems like most countries, they're turning a blind eye. Everyone's talking about the problem, but it seems like there's still little to no measurable action that's taken place to control that human population boom. Now, understand that's my own personal observation, and I think it's one we're all aware of, but it's a super, super touchy subject.
Yep. And one of these days, I will be more than happy to tell you about one of my proposed remedies for helping slow down the amount of procreation amongst humans, because it starts with my half of the species. Educate the females, educate them, give them, give equal rights. And, look at our nation. We went from having how many kids back in industrial in uneducated areas where women were stay at home, take care of the kids. That was your job, pop out kids and take care of them. Give them some education, and suddenly they either choose to procreate less or choose not to procreate at all. So, yep, that's my
Yeah,
fix.
and I was just going to say, usually most of the population booms are not in the first world countries. They
Yep.
have slowed down their birth rate, and so it's a lot of the underdeveloped countries that are still, and it's just the process in which a country goes through. And so anyway, they're
Educate the females. I will task you and all of our listeners, educate the females and watch what happens to populations. Because literally, I mean, it's a, there is a literal direct tie in the numbers. So
Yep, I
anyway,
agree.
I do want everybody to understand we are not trying to be anti-human here. We are simply trying to be pro-reality. What we need to strive for is striking a balance between human needs and earth needs. We need to take care of all the different parts that Mother Nature has bestowed on us, whether it's individual species or unique habitats. We have to strive for sustainable management and realize we are all one people in this together. Just because something isn't happening in your neighborhood or even in your country doesn't mean that it won't affect you. That's just really naive. So that means, keeping all the pieces around and not exploiting anything into non-existence, extinction, in other words, is critical. Whether it's terrestrial stewardship or the stewardship of our vast and incredible oceans, we need to take care of what we have because it affects us all.
Yeah, and do you have any idea how difficult that is? It'd be so simple if things were black and white, but these decisions we got to make on this subject, they're oftentimes very, very gray, and it requires an inordinate amount of thinking skills.
Well, that's exactly it, folks. This is why Daryl is always stressing on that critical thinking. There's agendas around so many, points. And while advocating is awesome, it should not be done under the guise of the whole truth or a documentary, which shouldn't be biased. That biased, perspective, it makes it smell like propaganda and agenda. And it is. Facts should not be skewed to fit an agenda. People should be given full truths and transparency so they can make informed decisions. It is your life. You are the one responsible and accountable for making your decisions, just like I'm responsible and accountable for my decisions. So I just wish that documentary was the actual truth rather than just a funneled flavor of the truth.
Yeah, and you know what? I think if our listeners haven't watched it yet, they really should. Now, I don't want them using what we talked about today, just our analysis of the show. We don't want them to use that to be informed because honestly, to put our show into context, they need the full picture, which boils down to you got to watch the show, folks.
Yeah, I'd second that with a graphic content warning.
Tell me, Steph, did that documentary actually change you?
Honestly, yeah, it did. In our field, we're already aware of terms like bycatch, and we're familiar with commercial fishing tactics, even if we did have to learn a little more to validate. The only recourse that we all have, because like you said, this is an international thing. The only recourse we have is to stop supporting the industry at all financially. That's it. So yeah, regardless of my personal love of shrimp, fish, calamari, and for the love of dogs, canned tuna, I have officially sworn off commercial fish products because honestly, I think globally we do have problems with commercial fishing and sustainability because, like you said, it's just they do what they want in the bycatch. is unacceptable to me, and I can't support it by being a consumer who fuels that industry with my money. So, I'm just one person. But and so my like my dad would be like, well, you're just one person. So what's, when I told him about this, what's one person going to do? Well, there's lots of just one persons that make a difference, because that when we're all together, that's no longer just one. So each one of us making just one choice. So it's a choice that I can make and I'm comfortable with. So when it comes to fish, if I don't catch the fish myself, I won't be eating it, or shrimp or calamari. And I admit, though, I will do some more research on fish farms before I make a decision on if I'm willing to eat farmed fish or not. What about you?
Well, that's not fair. You know how much I like tuna. Actually, I'm just teasing there because well, I shouldn't say thankfully, but I'm not a really big fish eater anyway. And usually what I do eat, it's the fish that I catch at the end of my fly line. And I will tell you there's pretty much nothing better than like smoked trout over a campfire when I'm lost somewhere in the Rockies. So will it change what I do? Probably not much, but I'm definitely more aware of the whole issue.
Yeah, I did find it interesting in the show that Sylvia Earle, she was in the show. She's an incredible ocean explorer from, the same era as like Jacques Cousteau. She's phenomenal. Anyhow, I like what she said, because she said something that I have said something so similar my whole life to anybody that I have conservation discussions about. Anything related to protecting our environment, she literally said something that is almost the exact the same as what I've said my whole life.
And what's that?
Well, like I said, she said it slightly differently, but I have always said, when it comes to things like recycling or reducing your carbon footprint, you don't have to do everything, but each one of us can and should do something. So make what change or changes that you can and that you can stick with. If all of us did just that, just making a little bit of change, we in mass, we're making a huge change and positive impact.
Yeah, those are very, very wise words. And I'd say that all the time too, in that all of us can make a difference. We might not make that huge monumental change, but enough of us making a small change, it will result in drastic changes. So anyway, as much as I'd love to continue this conversation, I think we're just past the 20-minute mark. Actually, we might be past the 60-minute mark, but we are, needless to say, we're well past our cutoff time, so we probably should start wrapping this up. I am going to, before I do that, I got to talk about a bear.
Oh, you're not. Seriously?
Well, really quick, when I was at the Bear Center, and this is going back the exactly everything we've been talking about now. When I was at the Bear Center, we were struggling for money, and we didn't know how to raise money. And I was contacted by an organization that was going to promote us and raise awareness, and they pretty much guaranteed we would get a lot of money coming in. But you know what they asked of me? They wanted me to send them pictures of little tiny bear cubs that were like super sick or injured, or those SPCA commercials where the dogs are just
Oh, yeah.
it pulls at your heartstring. But that's not what we're about. We weren't about painting this ugly, awful, tainted, biased picture. And so I refused to work with them because that was the pure smell of propaganda. And I wasn't gonna go in that direction right from the start of my career. So I feel better. I got my bear plug in. So anyway, let's wrap it up. You want the honors or should I take them?
I thought for sure I had a bear-proof topic.
What, talking about the ocean?
Yes.
Bears.
I was like, how, as long as he's not got a lot of experience with polar bears, maybe I can actually make this fly. Nope.
You stayed away from the Arctic.
I did. Anyway, no, go ahead. You better go for it with closing it up.
All right. Anyway, folks, we can't thank you enough for listening to this podcast. If you like what we're saying and it inspires you to think more critically, then we've done our job. Now, we completely understand that not everyone is going to agree with everything we say, and that's okay. We can come to different conclusions, but the key here is to draw your conclusions based on your research, not simply what someone else has told you.
Yeah, and don't forget to look at both sides. There are always two sides.
Obviously, that's a great point. If you look at the other side and you don't like what they're saying, that's perfectly fine. But here's the thing. Sometimes you may find out things you don't really know because, well, you simply never heard their side before. So the bottom line here, keep thinking, keep researching, keep striving to be better. And like Stephanie said, no one can do everything, but each one of us can do something.
Hey, I know one thing everybody here can do.
What's that?
They can share this podcast with, friends, family, and maybe even on their social media, Another thing that they can do is obviously they can go to the Wildlife For You webpage or Facebook page and like it. Spreading the word about wildlife, and conservation and everything we talk about definitely will make a difference. Do you know why?
Oh, I do. It's because when it comes to wildlife, your knowledge often means their existence. Good night, folks.
I could really go for a cheeseburger right about now.
Not me. I'm going for a tuna melt.
Daryl.